Deep in the bowels of the British Museum lies a recording that's different every time it plays. This is that recording. This is Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. What follows will contain very dark, very adult situations. Proceed at your own risk and feel free to turn back if it gets too much. After all, next week the recording will be different.
This is David Cummings from the No Sleep Podcast, and you're listening to Pseudopod.
Pseudopod, episode 490, May 13th, 2016. This week's story, Murmurs of a Voice Foreknown, by John Paget. Hello everyone, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from one of my favourite authors, John Paget. This is a Pseudopod original, by the way, and here's what John had to say about it. As an adult human being, I'm an odd misfit, but I was truly a ghoulish child. Small and rail thin, with a large, square face capable of making the most hideous expressions. I'm sure my dark humour and morbid bent are due in no small part to an older brother who delighted in telling me scary stories almost every night of my early childhood. My brother pathologically despised me when we were kids, and actively and creatively fed my fears and doubts when he wasn't physically causing me discomfort or pain. My earliest memories are filled with his threats, creepy lies, and bizarre improvised stories. Many years later, they still haunt my imagination. And I wrote this story with those memories in mind. John lives in New Orleans with his spouse, their daughter, and two cats. He has work out or forthcoming here, the Lovecraft e-zine, and Znoibiz, which I refuse point blank to try and pronounce any other way. It just sounds right. John's chapbook, The Infusorium, was released in spring of 2015, and his first short story collection, The Secret of Ventriloquism, is forthcoming from Dunham's Manor Press in June of 2016. Which means, in June of 2016, Dunham's Manor Press is going to get some of my money. Later in 2016, John, along with a team of editors and the artistic wizardry of Dave Felton, will be releasing the first issue of Vasterian, a source of critical study and creative response to the corpus of Thomas Ligotti and the authors who influenced and are influenced by him. And when that is released, they will be getting some of my money. Your reader for this story, who has a very difficult job, and they nailed it, is Paul Cram. Paul is a scrappy actor whose character in movies always seems to be the one that dies. His latest role in Anniversary has him awake at night seeing things that no one wants to admit are happening. While Paul still considered his voice to be somewhat new to the world of audiobooks, he has a few full-length novels under his belt, including The Love Story Flirting with Death, set against the beauty of Lake Michigan, and The Zombie Apocalypse. When not acting, Paul can be found out in the woods of Minnesota arguing pop culture with his little brother. Check out Paul's website at paulcramactor.com. And get ready, because your brother has a story for you. And he swears it's true.
Murmurs of a Voice Foreknown, by John Paget. Read by Paul Cram. I was 7 years old the first time my brother tried to kill me.
"Sam wants you dead,"
he whispered to me one day at our grandmother's house. My brother had received a pellet gun, something called a Crossman 760 Power Master, for his 12th birthday, and was parading it about, pulling and pushing the sleek, laminated brown wooden pump out of and into the black barrel again and again. Soon after our arrival, he dragged me outside to watch him fire the weapon upon the rusted, tin-roofed boat dock and the wood pilings which lined the back of grandmother's expansive backyard and the filthy canal beyond and below it. "That was you," he would say after each pellet hit its mark with a ping. My brother was a natural athlete, and his aim was superb. I was neither athletic nor interested in athletics of any kind. Instead, I spent those summer days capturing honeybees and fire ants and spiders, all shapes and sizes, in an otherwise empty juice bottle, its thin, golden metal top riddled with air holes, which I had fashioned with a long-handled ice pick. I remember watching for hours through warped glass as those thin-legged, diminutive inmates encountered one another. Sometimes more or less peacefully, sometimes with brutal but mesmerizing results. At the end of that particular visit at my grandmother's house, my brother, pumping his Crossman again perhaps 5 feet in front of me on our way to the car, turned around, aimed his gun's black proboscis at my head, and said, "Sam says shoot out your eye." Then he pulled the trigger. Had I not reflexively covered my face with my hands, there is no doubt the pellet would have found its mark, possibly causing permanent eye damage or worse. At the time, I was sure it would have killed me on the spot. I knew my brother hoped so as well. As it was, a miniature bullet struck my right hand's middle fingernail, which exploded into bloody fragments. It was the single worst thing I had felt in my short life till that point. I remember looking down at the alien, red numb of my nailless finger, my mouth open in a long howl of astonished disbelief. My brother's punishment was meted out in short order. He received a long spanking on the spot via the brush, always on hand, administered by my diminutive mother while the rest of the family, my sister, my father, my grandmother, watched. As always, my brother chortled through the brush's every whack, grinning at me as if imagining his pain transmuted into the many torments he would soon inflict upon me. I was the youngest of three children. My sister was the eldest, and my brother was the middle child. My mother's pregnancy with me was an unexpected and unwanted one. And no one, with the possible exception of my sullen father, wanted a younger sibling less than my brother, who had enjoyed all the benefits and privileges of being a baby of the family for some 5 years. The close, lively relationship he had enjoyed with his sister and mother was extinguished by degrees in the years following my birth. The longer my family focused their attentions on the new baby, a more needy, much less physically precocious one, the greater my brother's resentment towards me swelled. As I grew older, it became more and more apparent that I, a strange, sickly, unwelcome sibling, was unlike him in every conceivable way. With every passing year, my brother loathed the sight of me more, and I became the favored target upon which he concentrated all his grievances and rage. I received more injuries and humiliations from him than I can recall during my early childhood. Once, he nudged me off the back of his speeding bicycle, which led to a chin full of stitches. Other times I remember him slamming my hand in the car door, hurling me bodily into the sticker bushes in our front yard, and even shoving me backwards into the wood piling-lined, rainbow-sheened canal behind and below our grandmother's backyard. He had routinely threatened my life before the day he shot my fingernail off, usually as blackmail to keep me from tattling on him, but my brother had never actually tried to kill me before, and he had never before mentioned anyone named Sam. "Who's Sam?" I asked him one night soon after the pellet gun incident. We were both almost ready for bed, and my brother had just entered my room. He sidled up to me, smirking. His breath smelled like hard-boiled eggs. Then he put on the spooky voice, one to which I had grown accustomed each night when my brother would fill my head full of stories about the bodiless hand, crawling about on thin but powerful fingers under my bed, awaiting the perfect time to strangle me in my sleep. Or the grinning living doll who lived in an old trunk up in the attic just down the hall from my door. The doll whose sharp teeth were covered with an incurable poison. After I asked about Sam, my brother began his spooky-voiced story, as he often did, with one large knuckle jabbed hard into my tiny shoulder. I withstood the pain and tried not to whimper, I knew that would only make things worse.
Before you were born, Padbutt, Mom and Dad had another baby. His name was Sam. But little Sam died when he was just tiny.
Mom and Dad never said anything about...
Course not, dumbass. They told us after it happened to never say anything about it again. They said they were going to have another baby, but it turned out to be a bad mistake. That's just what Dad said to Mom, a bad mistake. So you were no Sam, and they knew it.
That's not true, I said, fighting back tears. And besides, if Sam's dead, how could he tell you to shoot me? My brother's smirk became a sneer, and his voice became a whisper in my ear as he pinched the back of my neck, hard.
Sam talks to me at night, baby britches. He's a ghost now, and he tells me it's almost time for you to be dead. And once you die, he's going to take over your body. You'll be gone, but he'll be back. And I might just kill you for Sam. I miss him. But I keep changing my mind about whether to do it or not. You tell Mom and Dad anything about this, though, and you can bet I will kill you. Dead.
My brother left me, trying not to blubber in my bed with a new demon to torment my sleep. Sam. The spooky voice tale deeply affected me, and many a night that followed, I sweated awake, under covers in the darkness, wondering when and how my brother would kill me to make way for dead Sam. How would it happen? What would it feel like to be pushed out of my body by something other? Would I see my own face grinning up at me with hilarity and malice as I just floated away and disappeared? Though, I had my doubts as to whether the hand or the doll existed, at least during the day. I was immediately certain that Sam, specifically the malignant shade of Sam, was real. Hadn't my brother tried to actually kill me? Hadn't my parents both been sad and angry over something unstated for as long as I could remember? In the months that followed, my brother mentioned Sam continuously.
Sam says stab you in the brain with the ice pick. Sam says to hold you under the water in the bathtub. Sam says to smother you with your pillow. Sam says it's almost time. Sam says it won't be long.
Such were the things my brother whispered to me at the breakfast table, in the kitchen, in my bedroom, in the den, in the front and backyards. Once, he even convinced me that Sam had spookily entered a statue of certain cherubic, laughing Buddha that had always frightened me. It sat like a lacquered brown beetle in my insect jar, in an attitude of eternal, uncanny glee on my parents' cluttered dresser. And my brother encouraged me to smash the thing.
You've got the chance now, big head, little body, my brother whispered. You break that statue apart and Sam dies for real and forever, and you're saved.
So I snuck the heavy Buddha figure outside that afternoon and dashed it against the sidewalk in front of our house, just as my brother appeared at the front door with my mother, pointing at me. Soon, sobbing, bent over a chair in the dining room, I received the brush treatment from my diminutive mother as my brother silently danced and taunted me through the doorway beyond her eyesight. After that, I worked even harder than usual to avoid being alone with him, spending as much time as I could with my teenaged sister, who acted as a well-meaning, if flimsy and inconsistent, bulwark against my brother's shenanigans and torments. One morning, however, my brother closed and locked the upstairs bathroom door while I was standing on a wooden footstool washing my hands. My parents and sister were safely out of hearing. Before I could bolt, he placed me in a tight, one-armed chokehold so that I was forced to look at both myself and my brother behind me in the bathroom mirror.
"This is poison," he said, and he held out a handful of bright red pills in his free hand.
At that, he overpowered me and pushed every one of the pills into my mouth.
"Look," he said, a snarling grin upon its face pointing at my image in the mirror. "That's your blood. You're dying."
Sure enough, a tremendous amount of red, frothy foam started pouring out of my mouth and down my face as I went limp in my brother's grip. Of course, the scary-looking pills were merely dental discoloring tablets, the kind used to reveal plaque on teeth. Completely harmless. But through the gales of my brother's laughter and my own sobs of relief and rage, I made the decision to take action against further torments. The night after the dental pill murder fake-out, I sat up in the darkness of my bedroom and considered my options. I had neither the courage nor the means to run away from home. My brother was much stronger and more cunning than me. I could tell my parents or my sister about his threats, but I knew what would happen from past experience. My brother would guffaw through another brushing, and things would be much worse, so much more painful for me. And if he killed me, and Sam possessed my dead body, my parents and my sister wouldn't know the difference. So what could I do to defend myself from further psychological and physical damage, or death? My brother was toying with me like a cat batting around a doomed bug, one of the insects or arachnids or grubs from the flowering hedges or underneath garden bricks or logs or within webs or nests in our carpet or backyard, the kind of creatures I daily collected in my jar. The little crawling and flying things that I observed and released, dead or alive. Honeybees, flies, centipedes, inchworms, spiders. I lacked the natural resources which most of these creatures had. I couldn't protect myself against ravenous predators like the roly-poly when it curls up in its armored shell. I lacked the wasp's sting or the spider's web spinning. I was slow, like the rice beetles which came out in abundance on warm nights. And I lacked their ability to fly. As these insects buzzed through my imagination in the pressing dark, a thought occurred unbidden to me. Maybe I am like a daddy longlegs. Yes, the spiders who my father once told me are not really spiders. The ones that spin no webs but amble about on elongated, fragile, segmented, needle-thin limbs. Legs which break off so easily when grabbed, never to grow back. The non-spider things that release a terrible, acrid, chemical stench when threatened. The pungent smell was unforgettable. I remember my brother once telling me that the small body and tiny head atop the gangling legs of the daddy longlegs had no sting or bite that could penetrate human skin. But, and he had said this with relish, the daddy longlegs poison was more venomous than any other spider, even if it was unusable, lacking any kind of effective delivery mechanism. Like the daddy longlegs, I was clumsy, slow, skinny, harmless. But was there not a hidden, potent venom within me? And if so, how could I access that poison and use it to protect myself against my brother's attacks? Or even use it to end his life before he inevitably ended mine? That night, following my brother's spooky voice bedtime story, Sam, as usual, persuading him to kill me, I sat in the gloom of my bedroom, counting to 1,000. My thoughts drifted to the hand under my bed. Each number I recited seemed punctuated by the noiseless sound of long fingers crawling up the foot of my bed, inching nearer and nearer to my scrawny neck. What if the hand under my bed was Sam's hand, preternaturally growing even after the death of the rest of his body? I forced those thoughts away and shifted my attention back to the plan, which began uncurling itself like a roly-poly within my head. My brother, so powerful and malignant during the day, would be helpless in sleep. Once the counting was done and the house quiet, I stood up and tiptoed through my open door towards my brother's bedroom, out into the hallway. My wary eyes alighted upon the ceiling attic entrance, where I feared the doll lurked. Past that entrance in the dark, I could go no further, paralyzed by worrying thoughts of the doll and her sharp, poisonous teeth. What if the doll and Sam were now one and the same? Another demon brother clothed in the form of that hideous figure. Would my death by poisonous bite be a prelude to undead possession? I slunk back to my bed and spent another night racked with those thoughts. All my brother's monsters, real or imagined, melding with jagged, segmented limbs and toxic stingers into a long and horrible nightmare. That nightmare lingered on into the next day, but became oddly divorced from the acute fear which accompanied it, as if the mechanism propelling last night's horror had stalled or shorted out, leaving the remaining nightmare trappings and imagery racing back and forth behind my eyes in a state of perpetual motion. And behind those nightmare after images, my brother's face, dark brown eyes shining with cruelty and rage, a focused cruelty and rage I began to feel as well. Then, the long-handled ice pick from the kitchen came unbidden to my thoughts, as if placed before me. With that weapon, I might stand a chance against Sam Hand, Sam Doll, my brother, whatever else might attack me in the darkness. That night again, I counted to 1,000. Again, I imagined clutching Sam Hand and grinning Sam Doll waiting to spring on me. But now I was brandishing the long-handled ice pick. Once my counting was done, I slid out of bed, holding the ice pick in front of me like a flashlight. At the far end of the hall, my brother's room stood, door ajar. I made it past the attic ceiling door above and slipped inside his bedroom, imagining myself insubstantial, invisible in the quiet night's darkness, becoming a part of that darkness. I creeped inside and looked around, anticipating ambush, but only my sleeping brother was revealed half covered by a thin blue blanket, mouth agape like a dead fish. He looked reduced and vulnerable, unconscious in his bed, weak. I took a deep breath and slowly, carefully, descended to the ground until my torso, arms, and legs were flat on the dusty hardwood floor, like a daddy long legs, like the hand. I crawled under my brother's bed and flipped over when I was more or less in the same position as my sleeping brother above. I considered the floor, my Ralphin limbs, torso, and head upon the floor, box screen inches above me, mattress upon box screen, and my brother upon that mattress, my oblivious, harmless brother. And above him, the ceiling with its globular extinguished light. And beyond that, my mind emptied of further thought. Experimentally, I placed the point of the long-handled ice pick on the slatted box screen below his covered mattress. The bottom of the box screen was covered with a kind of thin, rough fabric, almost like burlap, and I ran the ice pick lightly along it, listening to the soft zipping sound it made. From underneath the bed, I started adjusting my position, guessing where my brother's head might be up there. I closed my eyes and envisioned myself floating above him and set up below him, pressing the pointed metal of the pick onto my brother's soft, yielding eyelid. I pushed up against the box screen and applied just a little more force, and then a little more. flip. The pick, my stinger, entered the box screen. Big Brother's eye and brain in my imagination, and was suddenly within it to the hilt. I realized then that the box screen was largely empty, just a hollow frame with rough metal stapled around it. I lay underneath the bed in a kind of euphoric enlightenment for the longest time, musing over that emptiness and what could be used to fill it. Holding the ice pick within the box screen, directly under my brother's head, my mind clear of fear for the first time in memory. "That was you," I whispered to the invisible prone shape above me. I spent the next day pacing up and down the length of the flowering hedges in the backyard, collecting honeybees in my jar, and one, then two, Daddy Longlegs. For his part, my brother continued his habitual menace of me, but now his threat seemed as hollow as a box screen. "Sam says put you in the refrigerator tonight and hold the door closed till you die," he said. And I involuntarily chuckled in response. "Do you even know how long it'd take for me to run out of air in the fridge? How long you'd have to hold it closed? God, you're stupid." This response surprised both my brother and me. And in retaliation, he stuck a knuckle into my shoulder and squeezed the nailless pink flesh of my injured finger. He twisted it until I shrieked and tears began to run. Until he made me beg him to stop. My brother sneered with satisfaction, leaning close to me. "I've made up my mind, Twig. Sam's coming, and you'll be dead soon." But I knew it was my brother, not me, whose time was drawing to a close. That night, according to the next phase of my plan, I brought the long-handled ice pick, some duct tape, and a jar containing 7 bees and 2 Daddy Longlegs that I had collected earlier that day. Again, I counted to 1,000 and carefully crossed my dark bedroom and hall, less fearful of the hand, the doll, let alone Sam. Again, I slipped under my brother's bed with my equipment in tow. I inserted the ice pick into the eye-level, tiny hole I had created in the box screen the night before and twisted the pick around and around, widening the aperture until it was half as big as a quarter. Carefully twisting off the gold cap, I placed the jar's mouth against the hole I had made. I could smell the Daddy Longleg chemical protective fear stench that had been bottled up for hours and gagged a little. It struck me then that the bees, which had been lethargic for the last few hours, perhaps drunk on the foul odor, wouldn't willingly exit the jar and enter the box screen. But I was patient. I concentrated on making those occasionally buzzing shapes move. Eventually, one entered the dark cavern above them, whether from the force of my silent concentration or just to escape the acrid confines of the jar. Then another crawled into the box screen. Then another. When all the bees had entered the hollow space, I began pressing layer after layer of heavy tape upon the aperture I had made, trapping the insects. Afterwards, in the semi-darkness, I listened to the almost imperceptible erratic hum of the bees within my brother's box screen. Then, I set my ear against the rough fabric and listened to the buzzing, imagining my brother's head melting down into the mattress, and the box screen below that, watching in my mind's eye as 7 bees crawled one by one into his mouth and nostrils. "That was you," I whispered. Feeling empowered by that vision, I scooted out from under the bed and sat cross-legged beside it, unconcerned that my brother might awaken and unafraid of his associated boogies, real or imagined. Over the past 2 nights, I had been indoctrinated as one of them, hidden away in darkness like the doll, even lurking under a bed like the hand. And as for the malignant shade of Sam, his obsession with being rehoused in my dead body, well, That wasn't going to be a problem much longer. I jiggled my insect jar upside down until the two daddy long legs fell out into my small palm. They were both worse for the wear. Two disembodied limbs, one still twitching, had fallen along with the bugs, and both daddy long legs were trying without success to raise their small bodies upon their needle-thin legs that would no longer support any amount of weight. They had survived hours of honeybee terror and abuse, and now are being held in the hands of a nameless giant for a monstrous purpose. I pitied them. Slowly, almost tenderly, I closed my palm into a quivering fist, feeling the spasmodic jerks of daddy long-leg limbs and the two pea-like shapes of their bodies popping. The foul stench was almost unbearable now, and I stood up, holding my shaking little fist just over my brother's prone head, letting several drops of the daddy long-leg's bodily fluids drip into his open mouth, and finally tossing the remains of the unspiders under the bed as my brother gagged and coughed, sitting up convulsively. I collected my things and walked backwards, almost gliding out of his room, unconcerned now whether he saw me or not. My brother hadn't, though. He was still gagging and coughing. I had never felt more at peace, and my mind had never felt emptier or clearer. And that inner tranquility I had discovered inside myself would only deepen with time. The next morning, my brother was sick in bed, complaining of a bad night's sleep and a sore throat, and a buzzing in his ears, and a terrible taste in his mouth. I couldn't contain my glee when my mother told me. I was scolded for giggling, but she didn't understand. I knew there was so much more to come. No one knew I had become more cunning than the hand, more poisonous than the doll, more secret than Sam. Later that morning, the first of a new childhood, I ate my cereal, walked up the stairs, and paid my ailing brother a visit. His usually well-tanned skin looked pale and sweaty as he sat in bed, and, before he noticed me, I watched him shaking his confused head and twisting his index finger inside his right ear. "You look bad," I said, ambling up to his bed, staring directly into his dark eyes. "And you smell bad. Maybe Sam decided you'd make a better home for him than I would." But my brother didn't reach over and stick a knuckle into my scrawny shoulder in retaliation for my impudence this time. Now, I could tell he was afraid to touch me. That something fundamental in our relationship had shifted. He looked confused, diminished, and averted his own gaze from my steady one. "Bro, look," my brother said. "Sam isn't real. I made the whole thing up. And you don't have to worry anymore. I won't kill you. I wouldn't ever really kill you." "I know. I know you wouldn't kill me, bro," I said, grinning at him. "But one day, I'm going to kill you." And one day, I did.
I didn't get into fights at school. A big part of that was social expectation, at high school in particular. Riding to school in the same car as the head of English meant that the traditional adolescent misdemeanors had a way heavier price tag for me than most. So by and large, I stayed out of trouble. I broke a chair once, I managed to perfectly open the seam in my suit once, and yes, I went to school at a place where for the last 2 years he wore suits, and no, weird as it sounds, it wasn't posh. Posh was the public school a few miles away who would regularly destroy us at rugby, and where Russian oligarchs laundered both their children and money. Primary school, though, was a different story. I hit puberty first. My prize was a good 4 inches and 50 pounds more weight than most other kids would have for months or years to come. I was a nerd. I wore glasses. I was big. I was miserable. Because I was all of these things, in the barren, featureless wastelands of the very late 1980s, when all they did was draw a variety of new and interesting bullseyes on my back. So I got bullied. A lot. Never physically, because unfortunately the people bullying me weren't stupid, but I was always an outsider, and I was never allowed to forget that. My early school career was essentially an extended endurance exercise. Sit down, shut up, work hard, they'll go away eventually. They didn't, by the way. They just got older and had cooler hair than me. But there was this one time that this story reminded me of. For all that, I wasn't an antisocial kid. I had a lot of friends, but there was this one day where suddenly everyone decided to dogpile on me at recess, or break time, as we say on this side of the Atlantic. The game suddenly became to knock me over, and about 20 kids tried at once. As far as I remember, none managed. I do remember one clinging to my back and actually yelling, "By the gods, he has the strength of an ox!" And I remember, even through the embarrassment and the terror and the anger, that this little asshole was messing up my important afternoon of scrapbooking and working out who the best transformer was. Wheeljack, duh. I remember feeling relief. Pride. The moment here where the lead character realizes that his brother has a weakness and by extension he has a strength reminded me of that. It's the feeling of putting a load down you've been carrying so long you barely notice it, and it's so powerful. It's like stepping out into a big room in your head you don't remember being there before. It's like cleaning a whiteboard. You're not afraid anymore. And you've been afraid when this happens for so long, you've forgotten what not being afraid feels like. And it feels incredible. And that's when the real danger hits. Because like Frankenstein's monster once put it, once I am unbound, I am unbounded. I was perennially, throughout my high school career, I would probably argue up to the end of my bachelor's degree, two bad days away from being the bully, not the bullied. Even at high school, in fact, especially at high school, if I'd wanted to, I could have taken pretty much any kid who messed with me. And by taken, I mean 9 times out of 10, I would have folded them sideways and put them through a wall. There were days when I wanted desperately to do that. There were days when I was provoked to the point where that could, by some lights, be a completely understandable response. Most often, those were days with a Y at the end. I didn't get into fights at school. The odd pushing and shoving match, a couple of chokeholds, I was good at those. Nothing to write home about. Nothing that broke skin or changed the shape of facial features, mine or theirs. Because I knew if I did that, I'd heal. But I and they would change. Forever. And worse, I would always be that kid. I would always be defending that title. And someone would always be chasing me. That's the lesson the lead never learns here. He'll always be the kid who put bees in the bed. He'll always be the small, weird one. He'll always be alone. He won't always take satisfaction from that. But by the time he realizes something needs to be done, it'll be too late. Elegantly done, as ever, John. And Paul, thank you both. Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors and cover our server costs. And there are two ways you can do that. The one we prefer, and I know that sounds self-serving, but the simple truth is this actually helps more, is weirdly the cheapest. You can subscribe to us for as little as $2 a month. There are levels above that, but you would be amazed just how much those tiny little amounts help. You'd also be amazed, and maybe kind of horrified, at just how few listeners really do subscribe. It's very much a case of the few, the proud, the desperately needed. So if you do have the opportunity and the means, please do help out. Alternatively, if you've just won the lottery, then you can donate. That can be any amount you want, and that's a one-off. Both those options can be accessed through going to pseudopod.org and clicking on Feed the Pod. And please believe me, we are desperately grateful for every cent we get. Pseudopod will return next week without me, Alex is in the big chair, and with The Second Act by Nicholas Escobar. Then, as now, it will be a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod wants to remind you, its skin did explode, leaving only a shred.